This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Go on YouTube and search for MIT Media Lab. You'll see things that, assuming you're in any way gadget inclined, will blow your mind.
We call this a bidirectional screen, or BiDi screen for short.
A man manipulates graphics by touching a screen. Nothing new there. But then he pulls his hand back and continues to manipulate the image just by gesturing in the air.
We show that by slightly displacing the light sensing layer from the LCD, we can use the LCD to modulate the light reaching the sensor layer and thereby sense depth as well as position.
The Media Lab has turned out scores of inventions since it was founded in 1985. But perhaps most notably, the folks there invented a way of funding research that's given them incredible creative freedom. Corporate sponsors turn over cash, usually without any particular project or goal in mind, and MIT students and faculty go wild. Whatever comes out the other end, sponsors get to use in their products. The system worked like gangbusters through the 90s. It nurtured the seeds of ideas ranging from Google Street View to Guitar Hero. But the dot-com bust threatened to bring it all down. Companies wanted a more immediate return on their investment, while Media Lab researchers felt their freewheeling blue sky style was essential to their success. Enter Frank Moss. The former IBM exec and tech entrepreneur took over as head of the Media Lab in 2006. He's now widely credited with reinvigorating the lab, both with money and with creative spark. He recently announced he'll be stepping down next year to rejoin the private sector. Frank Moss joined us to talk about the future of innovation and the secret to his Media Lab success.
I think what I was able to bring in, quite simply, was I'm a business person. By background, I'm an entrepreneur and a business person, and I understood, maybe as an academic could not understand it, what was going on the other side. So if I have a sponsor from Procter & Gamble, for example, a new sponsor that we're very active with, I understand what the people from Procter & Gamble have to do when they go into their annual reviews, the ROI, or return on investment. You couldn't have expected that from the academics who created the Media Lab.
Could you give me one or two concrete examples of what some of your corporate sponsors have gotten back in return for their investment?
Okay. Way back in the 80s, one of the major research areas at the lab was music. Although music is everywhere today, and we know that, we hear it in our iPods, and it's surrounding us in elevators and everywhere. But there's actually been a very constant change over the last century away from people producing music. And so at the Media Lab, we said, how can we enable ordinary people, not musicians or professionals, to create music, and actually brought professionals into the Media Lab, one of them Yo-Yo Ma, and instrumented them, their bow, their cello, their instruments, to discover how they make music so that could then be turned into a capability for people to create music. And we actually instrumented the bow of Yo-Yo Ma, or they did before I came, and they gave performances at the MIT Kresge Auditorium and around the country. This was an experiment called the Hypercello. Well, when Penn and Teller, the magicians, back in those days, saw this, they came in the lab, and celebrities were coming into the lab left and right back then. It was a destination for the digerati and celebrities. They said, well, could you take that same capability that you just did for Yo-Yo Ma and create a magic chair, a seance chair, for us to use in our magic show, whereby we sit in the chair, we gesture our hands, and we create music just like the mystics did of old when they gave shows and they moved their hands and it conjured up spirits in the form of music. Well, they did. They built a chair called the Seance Chair that they used in their Las Vegas show and in several shows throughout the world that allowed Penn and Teller to sit in the chair and use the same electric field sensing that was used for Yo-Yo Ma's bow. Fast forward a little bit more into the early 90s when a representative of a car company came into the Media Lab and said he was thinking about the problem of small adults and children in the passenger side of an automobile. And how could you cut off the airbag knowing that they're there because if you don't, sometimes it deploys and can do great damage to a child or a young adult. And he saw this electric field sensing that was used by Penn and Teller and said, could we use electric field sensing in automobiles? To make a long story short, they licensed the technology to electric field sensing that was developed for Yo-Yo Ma's cello, for Penn and Teller. And today, many automobiles, a good deal of automobiles, use the technology that was developed at the Media Lab for electric field sensing to cut the airbag off if it senses there's a small adult or a child. So that's kind of the classic progression of technology for something that you really didn't at all intend. We call that process serendipity by design. Fast forward to today in my group called New Media Medicine, where our passion is to do a similar thing for medicine that the Media Lab did for music and for media in the past, which is enable ordinary people to take control of their own health care.
Now, this is a very timely project, obviously, because health care and revolutionizing health care is in the news all the time.
Right.
I understand that this new media medicine project you have even has a fake doctor's office with an examination table.
That's my workshop. You just described it. And so most spaces at the Media Lab look more like workshops and kind of wild and crazy research spaces. What we decided to do was actually to create a simulation of the doctor's office of the future and next to it, the living room of the future, to populate this with all the sensors, the devices, the smartphones, the capabilities for people to both measure and control their data, and then to build applications that actually demonstrated this. If you imagine a gigantic screen in the doctor's office that's a multi-touch screen, so instead of going into the doctor's office and he or she sits there at his computer or her computer typing away your electronic medical records while you're sitting there trying to figure out what they're doing, you're both interacting together on a multi-touch screen, just like that screen on CNN where they show the political landscape or the coming hurricane and they move things around. And you'll look at the results of your test. You'll look at the amount of calories that you consumed yesterday, the food that you ate, maybe the medications that's being suggested. And graphically and visually, just as you're used to doing now on an iPad or an iPod or a phone, you'll move that around and you'll work with your physician in the office to do that. And then when you go home, you'll have the same view. So it's a collaborative model that way, way ups the level that patients participate with physicians. The healthcare system today radically underestimates the capability of people to take control of their healthcare, to have control over and access to the information about their health, both that which exists today and the huge amount that's going to exist in the future as we're measured in terms of everything we do. Put that in the hands of ordinary people. Give them the tools to understand that data, to both prevent disease and to manage their primary and chronic care, and then make a collaboration between them and doctors. And we do that in this simulation of a doctor's office in a home environment, and we've attracted so many companies right now who are our sponsors to be thinking about how their businesses can actually participate in the consumer health revolution that will be spawned in the future.
You seem so enthusiastic about what the Media Lab is doing. Why are you leaving?
Well, because I want to make it happen at scale in the world. It's been 5 years. That was the time frame that I allocated to this. I'm passionate about many things, but one thing is the failure of the healthcare system to recognize what I just talked about, the frustration at looking at healthcare reform and saying, well, I'm for healthcare reform, but this just scratches the surface. Unless you get to the bottom of what really is at the ills of the healthcare system, and technology can really help revolutionize that, we're not going to make a difference. So I want to go out, apply my entrepreneurial and business skills, combined with what I've learned in the Media Lab, and help make some of this happen at scale. I think it also applies very much to the problem of aging in our society, which is one that, well, when you get to be my stage with regard to parents and others, you begin to experience it. And it is one of the biggest problems coming down the pike at us. And technology can really make a difference, but not much is happening, and I want to make that happen.
So are you trying to very actively get back in the game of bringing innovative business technologies to market and launching new companies? Is that what you want to do by leaving the Media Lab?
Yeah, go out and create. People are now talking about social entrepreneurship. You know, companies that are created that both create profit and that do good for society. I think it's a great idea, but I haven't really seen this pulled off yet in any significant way. So I'd like to be one of the first to develop a social entrepreneurship ventures, their companies, that really can move these kinds of technologies into society at scale.
And is there a specific one you can tell us about?
I can give you a general idea. You know, I think one of the biggest challenges is to begin with people in their homes and to enable them to do what people are now called the quantified self, to collect the information about themselves, what they did during your day, you know, what you ate, what the calories you burned, your habits and so forth, because that's such an important part of your electronic medical picture. But, you know, we're not going to be wearing wristbands and devices all over our bodies. We're not going to turn into our own system administrators in a way that I think people now imagine. We're going to measure these things in the context of our everyday life. Let me give you an example of a project at the lab that I may or may not bring to fruition, but the kind of thing. It's called a medical mirror. It's this mirror that when you walk into your bathroom, and there's actually a camera behind the mirror, and it's a very high-precision camera that images your face. And believe it or not, very subtle changes in your face occur every time your heart beats. And a camera with the kinds of algorithms and capabilities that can pick that up can immediately tell your heartbeat and your blood pressure in the morning. When you shave, as I do, you always get a little bit of a cut, and I always say, how can that be an upside? Well, perhaps you could take a blood sample in the morning, use the toilet, there's a urine sample, and so forth. And so I think there's the opportunity to create devices, consumer electronics and consumer product devices, that actually begin the process of instrumenting your home so that ultimately you'll go into a Best Buy or another retailer, and rather than just buying your home TV setup and your home internet setup, you'll walk into another room, which is your bathroom, and perhaps your family room, and you'll equip that with the monitors and devices that you need to manage your own health care. I think all homes will be equipped with those in the future. So that's one area where I think new products and innovation really needs to be brought to the market.
I understand you're working on a book about the, quote, innovation crisis in the U.S. How do you define that innovation crisis?
Well, I would define it quite simply, and that is innovation is the process of putting new ideas and inventions into practice. I think the crisis is based on the fact that so many people recognize that. I mean, you read it all the time in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and on the blogs. Everybody knows, you know, we're not innovating enough, and to compete internationally and globally, we need to do that. But what they're not simply saying is that you've got to feed that pipeline with ideas and with inventions. And no one's investing in those nowadays. The corporate labs have shut down. We're on quarterly earnings pressures in companies. And I think we haven't got a formula right now for saying, how can we invest in research that doesn't have a particular direction? Companies themselves are not in a position to do that. But even worse, when I look at how our government funding works, and I know this is a big issue, and that's been funding research here, basic research in the United States for the past 60 years since World War II, I think it's brain damaged. If you're a smart graduate student or professor in a university, you have a great idea. In order to get money for it, you have to submit it to a peer review process where eight peers have to agree that this is a good idea. And my feeling is if eight peers agree that it's a good idea and something you ought to do, then it's probably not very innovative.
So you think peer review is an outdated way of doing
research? I think peer review is an outdated way of doing it. I'm not going to say peer review can go away in this the huge industrial research and academic complex that we have in this country, but I think we have to begin to replace it with something. And I think there's got to be a new relationship between industry and academia. I think that's the future.
But, of course, we have seen that even with peer review, things get published that aren't legit. So without it, what is the system that makes sure that things are thoroughly vetted?
Well, I think it's the same thing in your business, in the journalism business. You can say, well, we have so many people who are blogging and talking, and how do you know, professional journalists need to do the fact-checking, right? Well, I don't have an answer to that, but I think that our society needs to come to a new set of rules by which, you know, open research or open media work. And the way to do that isn't to try and enforce it through peer review. I think that itself will work itself out because once you open the system up, it will develop the kinds of controls, but the kind of controls that come from the people who are doing the work, not from government regulators. So I'm not going to deny that it's an important issue to make sure that scientific research continues to be well-respected and well-understood, and you just can't publish anything. But that shouldn't stand in the way of opening up the system so that true innovation can be done with the kinds of openness and creativity that occurs at the Media Lab. And in this book, and I'm not suggesting that you can have 100 or 1,000 Media Labs, but I think you can look at the forces that drive the Media Lab and the model that goes behind it, and I think it can inform a lot of what we do, particularly, I think, the area of a new relationship between industry and academia. I think that's where the growth is going to come.
Frank Moss, thank you for coming on Radio Boston.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Frank Moss recently announced he's stepping down as head of the MIT Media Lab. He says he'll stay through early next year until a replacement can be found. After a break, we talk Patriots with Bill Littlefield. Plus, we remember the Boston attorney who shamed toy companies into making their products safer.
There were things at the time like bows and arrows, literally bows and arrows sold on toy shelves, dolls with pins in the hair.
Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.